I'm Dan Diamond, host of the new Politico Pulse Check podcast. The question that folks in health policy are grappling with every day, how is this industry transforming itself? No one would know better than Andy Slavitt. He runs Medicare and Medicaid. It's the $1 trillion gorilla shaping all of healthcare and running point on implementing Obamacare. I've always been interested in Andy's story. This is a guy who was a superstar in the private sector. He was in charge of Optum for United Healthcare, which has now emerged as the single biggest driver of profits for the nation's biggest health insurer. And he gave it all up 2 years ago to join CMS. Andy first helped fix the broken Obamacare exchanges, and then, in a remarkable ascent, he took over as acting administrator. Getting to talk with Andy for this podcast, it was fascinating and even fun. He offers guidance on how a Republican president could pick his successor. He talked pretty frankly about how CMS lost the hearts and minds of doctors, his words, and how the new physician payment rule called MACRA is going to get them back. We also talked about why Andy's use of Twitter scares the bejesus out of his colleagues, though he used a different word. And then we ran through a lightning round of fun questions at the end, you know, including whether healthcare is one word or two words. If you check the episode notes, you'll see time cues that push you to those moments and others too. Given Andy's perspective, I thought this was an excellent conversation to launch our new Pulse Check podcast. You can find Pulse Check on iTunes and other apps. Just search for Pulse Check. Please rate us and subscribe and email me suggestions for who you'd like to hear on upcoming shows. I'm at ddiamond@politico.com. And with that, here's Andy Slavitt. Your commute into the office.
Right.
Everyone has a different commute story in Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Well,
what is your commute?
Yeah. My pre-commute story is, I just want to tell you that Pulse is the first or second thing I read every morning. And what I would read first is I always check to see if any kind of beneficiary emails came in that were emergencies overnight, because people do email the administrator if, for example, their wheelchair needs a battery or something like that, or all kinds of situations. But so absent those emails, you're my first read pre-commute.
Out of interest or concern?
To decide whether I'm going to get out of bed that day sometimes. Because, you know, it's funny because you'll sometimes get a letter the same time I get it. So if there's a letter from the Hill, depending on how they send it to me, if they don't send it to my direct email box, but they just send it over to our legislative affairs team, sometimes I'll find out I got the letter by reading Pulse or something else. And I'll go, oh, that's I didn't know that.
It was just kind of my reaction too. Speaking of those letters, I've always wondered, Andy, how many of those letters from the Hill, from industry groups, from beneficiaries, they're all addressed to you.
Yeah.
How many do you actually read?
Well, so the first question is, how many do we get? And, you know, I think this is maybe apocryphal, but I think there's something like 27 a week or something that come in from the Hill, lots more from beneficiaries and so forth. One of the decisions that I made against most people's advice was to keep one email address, a public email address. Most people said, keep a private email address because you're going to get barraged with email campaigns and lots of consumer issues and physicians and people will be upset about things and so forth. And I didn't do that. And it actually turned out to be a really smart decision because it helped me orient myself to the job, which is that the job isn't necessarily just about healthcare policy. The job is actually about 140 million people, and most of them low income or fixed income, who are in pretty vulnerable situations. And you can't get very far away from that. So, you know, I will say I pay a lot of attention to those letters. You know, the policy letters, some of them, if they're, you know, from, you know, a constituent or if they're from an interest group, they may, the first read may need to be with Medicaid or with Medicare or with some area. And then they'll brief me up on it because it may be that they're the people that need to get it and act on it quickly. And I think there's a pretty good routine system for getting the letters to the right place.
So just taking a step back and talking a little bit about you, how you came to be here. I was prepping for this conversation. You've been a consultant, investment banker, company founder, high-ranking United healthcare official, now federal leader. Am I missing anything along the way?
You know, maybe, but I think you probably hit all the, you know, unimportant landmarks in my life, in one form or another, at least on the work side. It's interesting because, you know, I would say the kind of key in my career has been finding bigger and bigger platforms to solve really the same problem, the same sort of set of healthcare problems that I think we all face. You know, I got into healthcare, and I don't know if you know the story, Dan. My roommate from college got a brain tumor when we were both recently married and both out of college a little bit, probably 10 years out of college. And he ultimately ended up dying from that brain tumor about 6 months later. And it obviously changed the life of his widow and he had twin one-year-old kids who are now freshmen in college. But it changed our lives as well, not just because we lost Jeff, but because my wife and I had his wife and their kids move in with us, and we sort of got a glimpse of what it is like and what it feels like to be completely vulnerable,
right?
In every dimension. And I think, you know, you can be the most powerful person in whatever domain you happen to live in, but when you get to be at the mercy of the healthcare system, you're completely vulnerable. And in his particular case, the lesson that came out abundantly clear was how people who have healthcare that have services that are uncovered, either they're partially insured in their case or completely uninsured, have the most difficult and most unfair time. So, you know, I got into healthcare really to start a company to try to solve that problem. It was late 90s, early internet days. Everything was possible. The internet was going to solve all our problems. And
how's that working out?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, Twitter is a wonderful thing. It's not quite what we thought it would be, but it did in my case, I think, begin a journey that, of course, you have no idea how it's going to begin. And I actually think a lot of people are in healthcare for some personal reason,
right?
Like that, some personal story.
So at that point, and we're talking 97, 98, you had been on the financial side. Now you're a founder of a healthcare company. In retrospect, what didn't you know about the healthcare system that you needed to know to get in and start this company? And at the same time, what special advantages did you have as someone coming from the private sector even then?
Yeah. So I think you always have to start a company with as much naivete as you can possibly muster, because it's always harder than you know. The trick, and this is the most important thing probably of all, is the trick is as you get to bigger and bigger platforms, never ever to lose that sense of feeling of what it's like to be very, very vulnerable at the center of this system. And so that's what I think, you know, coming into this job where you are connecting to and working on behalf of tens of millions of citizens and residents of this country, it's very easy to get into the big policy world, spinning whiteboards and drawing, you know, big policy parameters of how you can change the world. But if we get far from where care happens and where people live, you make big policy mistakes.
I want to point out for listeners, we're sitting in Andy's office. I see no whiteboards here, but reminders of patient mission. So how do you make that real, Andy?
Yeah.
Understanding that there are 130, 140 million people getting covered, how do you remember that waitress or that vulnerable person who might be depending on
the service? Reality is you can't write policy here behind your desk. And that's kind of an ethic, certainly at least since I've been here, that we've really tried to push people on. And, you know, I got to the government, sort of a real live case was to come in and lead the turnaround in healthcare.gov, where I think it was a shining example, among other things, of the fact that this is all about roll up your sleeve time now in healthcare reform. this is not about big policy meetings and talking to each other about, you know, what is quality? How might we theoretically cover people? This is the time when we actually make healthcare affordable. This is the time when we actually do it. So seeing us move and seeing CMS move to an operational stance where we're rolling up our sleeves means a couple things. One is it means what a phrase that we've coined called user-driven policy design.
Right. Where I've heard you mention this now several times.
Right. I'm probably the only person to mention it, but it's
spell it out, please.
It means something to the people here, which is how can you possibly add a regulation, create a regulation, as well-meaning, as thoughtful as that might be, if you don't know what it's like when it's going to hit the care system? Because chances are it's a regulation that will set on top of two or three other regulations that were put forward in the last number of years. And it may be that this very noble, thoughtful idea will end up being relegated to the compliance department, some hospital, as a cost of doing business, as opposed to something different. So one of the hardest things to do in life is to engage with your critics, and of which we have plenty, right? So you take something like the new MACRA legislation that was passed by Congress last year. That is a transformative opportunity for the Medicare program, but you have to be very ginger with anything you change about how you are measuring physicians who feel very overmeasured and are, how you pay physicians, because it's the predictability or lack of predictability there impacts them very significantly. And they're taking care of our people every day.
Right.
So getting out into the field, we went into 8 local communities. This is an example of what I mean by user-driven policy design, and sat in rooms with physicians. And we went out to physician offices and literally watched them deal with the regulatory issues they had to deal with and the reporting issues they had to deal with on behalf of patients. And it's exciting. I mean, actually, for the staff, for me, for all of us, it's exciting. And the best way, to come full circle to your question, the best way not to forget it is to just put that in your face at all times as much as possible.
If you want to turn the microphone a little bit closer towards you.
She was really talking to you, not me.
I mean, I figured if anyone was going to screw up, it would be me who...
Right.
Yeah. Well, this is an alien environment for me, Andy. Your office is brand new as of this morning. It's not yet a safe space.
You know, the CMS like inner sanctum is it actually felt that way to me when I got here too, because you know CMS impacts all walks of healthcare, and it always felt a little bit opaque to me as well. So I remember, you know, people walk into this conference room. And they have expressions on their face like, you know, I can't believe I'm here and I've got 30 minutes to make my points. And so I'm actually trying very, very hard to demystify this place by talking very clearly about what we're trying to accomplish using Twitter, which scares the crap out of my colleagues.
But you're so good at it. You need to stay on it. That would be one of my urging lessons for you.
Well, you know, what's important about it is it's a great way to listen, and it's a great way to demystify this place, because we have to be really engaged in the healthcare system. To my earlier point, we can't be writing regs here based upon sort of thoughtful policy ideas. We have to be really principally engaged, and I'm sure there are other ways besides Twitter that are better, and hopefully we're taking advantage of those as well. But for me personally, it's keeping me connected.
Well, since you brought up Twitter, I was going to ask about it later, but I'll ask now. You seem remarkably liberated to, I think so. Your team might have a different view, but you seem liberated to weigh in on the issues of the day. I think folks are responding. You started tweeting maybe 5 or 6 months ago, already have thousands of followers. What is that about? Is that you? Is it the fact that this is the last year of the administration? Is there some bigger strategy or goal there?
So let me put this in a little bit of perspective. So when I got here, it was on the healthcare.gov turnaround. And I think the most important thing was getting the operating and execution chops of this place right and what it should be, because we are all so dependent on CMS to be successful. Put aside what you believe, and from a policy perspective, this place needs to execute well, and it can, and it is. And then the first year, I spent a lot of time. I went to every region, met with thousands of employees, really talking about the question of what does CMS need to be doing to be successful 5 and 10 years from now? Mm. How do we need to be different? What do we need to be doing? Getting people engaged in that question, but also getting our operating chops right. And ICD-10 rollout was actually our first kind of go of it with the new user-based policy design approach, more nimble government, and to demonstrate to ourselves and everyone else that we can execute. But the idea was to be able to go into 2016 and play offense. And by offense, I mean a proactive agenda where we can actually assist and provide the tools and capabilities to people in healthcare who are going through a tremendous amount of change to not only survive, but to thrive. Patients, physicians, and to really get engaged. So, you know, we spent times figuring out what it is that we want to accomplish. What's the intentionality of what we want to accomplish? And if you look at the things that I cover on Twitter, they tend to hit those themes: health equity, primary care, making sure that the Medicaid program passes the what I call the "my sister" test, which is if my sister were on Medicaid, would I feel really, really good about that or really, really concerned about that? You know, we've taken a lot of actions, you know, in that regard. You know, payment reform, which includes, how do we look at the question of drug costs? How do we look at the change management tools and capabilities we need to put in place in hospitals and physicians? So, you know, it helped when the team was able to catch its breath and say, we actually have some pretty shared perspectives about what we need to accomplish. They're I think, well connected to where I think Congress would like us to be. I think they're well connected with administration policy. With that, you know, I think it does all of us a lot of good for us to be more open and engaged and easier to connect to.
There's still a little bit more I want to know about your path here. You've alluded to this, Andy, that you were working on the exchanges as a contractor in 2013 with Optum, UnitedHealth, QSSI. And I feel like the moment when most of the public was introduced to you was October 2013. The exchanges not going so well, to be frank, they failed to launch.
I hadn't heard. Yeah.
Well, you had to speak on this to Congress. And I feel like I remember that hearing. It was a rough hearing at the time.
Yeah.
Let's see, a Slate reporter who watched those hearings wrote that you weren't a techie or a project manager and that your, quote, expertise is in extracting as much money as possible from the government and procurement contracts. And judging by the numbers, you're very good at it. In retrospect, do you think those criticisms were fair?
No, I mean, obviously don't think those criticisms are fair, although I'm sure there's plenty of valid criticism for the things that we have and we do every day. You know, at the time, I think there weren't a lot of people running towards the fire, let's be honest. And so, you know, picking up the phone and calling and saying, you know, we may be able to help. And we were in a unique position to be able to help because we owned this small company we'd acquired called QSSI, who had built the data services hub, which is connected to the program and was functional and was working. But there were other things that weren't working. But they had a bird's eye view. And then, of course, I was working in an organization that had a lot of resources. And what I said when I came in and talked to Marilyn Tavener was, not a consultant, going to treat this like a consulting project, but if you need help, whether you need us to help in a unofficial way, I didn't know anything about how the proper way to engage. I just said, whatever help you need, technology projects get into trouble all the time,
right?
All the time. And
Usually this, not on this scale or in the public eye.
Usually not with this visibility. But that can be an asset. The visibility can help, can kind of be a good forcing mechanism to go faster. But I said, here's what I can tell you. I don't know how to do things the government way, not because I don't respect it, but I just don't know it. But I will do this. I will treat this problem like it's my own. And October 24th came here from, you know, left, said goodbye to my wife and my boys, and didn't return until the website was, you know,
functioning. October 24th, 2013.
Yes, 2013.
Yeah.
So it was a, it was one of those situations that felt to me like we just couldn't fail. I mean, as a country, as a, the consequences of not being successful would really deflate people's perspectives in whether or not government could work, could implement a big, complicated program like this. Could the healthcare system get better? And, you know, we sit here today proudly saying that 20 million people have coverage that wouldn't otherwise have it, and a lot of other things. And we're not done, and there's a lot more to do. But it felt like I had watched, and many others had watched, year after year after year, us talking about the same problem over and over. Can't cover the uninsured, can't make quality better. And I was tired of going, quite frankly, to big meetings and seminars and small meetings and talking about this
problem. The same problem.
The same exact problem. And so when the law passed, you know, my perspective is that this law could be the best thing to ever meet healthcare, or quite opposite, depending on how it's executed, depending on how it's implemented. And so, you know, the opportunity became, can we do this well? Can we do this well, which means can we do it transparently, with urgency, thoughtfully, and with a lot of cooperation from people, with a lot of learning and listening. And, you know, coming from business, you learn to be self-critical. In Washington, being self-critical is a little less safe. But, you know, we had to introduce that ability to say, oh, this worked, this didn't, we've got to adjust. So, you know, I think that's kind of the mode.
And to credit you, the team that ended up coming together, famously the Obamacare trauma team on the cover of Time magazine, you were right in the middle of that effort to bring accountability, something that Jeff Zients, who I know from the advisory board, also mm-hmm. a private sector guy or, mm-hmm. or a guy with private sector experience, bring that to the organization. So we're talking about the end of 2013. Fast forward half a year, you are making the decision to walk away from what had been very successful private sector background, join an administration in the second half of the second term. I'm tremendously interested in this next question, because I too have made job changes right. recently, but not on the same level. But how did you know that this was going to be what you wanted to do, given the level of risk and the fact that there's probably going to be a terminus on
sure.
how long you'd be in seat?
So the hardest part, truly hardest part, was my boys are teenagers. I've had an amazing wife. Couldn't imagine being away from them for any other purpose. It was clear, just given kind of where my boys were in school, that they weren't going to move to Washington. So that was really the hard part. But the opportunity to serve, and I'll tell you this, you know, it's interesting, Dan, you're attracted to this job for the big things, delivery system reform, covering the uninsured, all that. You actually fall in love with the job for the little things, all of the people and all of the programs that you get to help every day. That's turned out to be the nice surprise. But of course, you don't know that going in.
What's your favorite program?
My favorite program.
Could ask you your favorite person, but program seemed a little safer.
I'm kind of an underdog person. So, you know, anything we do to treat the most vulnerable, Medicare doesn't have a problem with 67-year-old joggers with 3 Fitbits, right? We have problems with people who are living with disabilities, people who are living in rural areas who don't have a lot of access. The dual eligible program, the OneCare program in Massachusetts,
The PACE program, maybe? The PACE program?
The PACE program would be a great example, where you can see, and what's unique about PACE and about OneCare is it's a model that starts with the individual and all of their needs and then works out around it, as opposed to being organized around the way people do their jobs. And those are exciting programs to watch.
Getting back to your transition into government, I've read about other CMS administrators coming in, though I'm not sure anyone had quite your depth of private sector background, health IT expertise. But at the same time, you had not been a high-level government official. All of a sudden, you are responsible first for healthcare.gov and then later for all of CMS. How did you get up to speed quickly? And how far along are you on mastering everything that CMS is responsible for?
So like everybody in healthcare, you're in and around, and I've been in and around all of these programs my entire career. My job wasn't actually to master everything, because the staff here, if I were to write a note to my successor, who I think about a lot, right, because I'm 9 months away from very likely the end of this term and the end of, and then, you know, someone else coming in. In some ways, I work for my successor now. So I think about all the things that they would need to know and they would need me to do and would want me to be doing in this last period of time. But the staff is phenomenal.
This is something a lot of people are wondering about in the healthcare community. What happens if that successor is appointed by a Republican president? We've got Donald Trump saying he's the presumptive Republican nominee. Trump has also said he wants to get rid of the Affordable Care Act if he's president. What are you doing now to prepare for the possibility of a Republican president who could potentially undo a lot of the progress on Affordable Care Act implementation?
Yeah. So there's certain things that are beyond even our control here. Sort of the political element of what happens next, clearly it's beyond our control. What's really interesting, though, is I'd say the lion's share of what we do really isn't political. It can be viewed through a political lens. But what we're responsible for on a day-to-day basis is something that has, I think, a lot of universal bipartisan support, which is making sure we take as good a care as possible of the people who rely on these programs, and B, that we do it in a way that the program's still here when people my age and subsequently your age need to use any of these programs. And if you stick to those things, I think you end up knowing how to navigate. My advice, if I were going to give advice to the next president or secretary of what kind of person to put in this job, I think, I would say a couple things for that very reason. One is, don't put anybody in this job who needs this job. Don't put anybody in this job who views it as a stepping stone, who needs to make friends, who's looking to build relationships to take this to somewhere else. You got to put someone in this job who will view this as the last and ultimately most important thing that they do, because there's a lot of opinions on these issues. And the second thing I'd say is, put someone in this job who knows what it's like to feel vulnerable, to not be able to access the care system, and or to know what it's like to deal on the ground with a lot of the burdens that come with having to deal with things coming out of Washington and so forth, as opposed to someone who has sort of more, different types of traditional policy background, because this agency is going to be so important in healthcare and needs to engage so directly in those kind of very same things.
So I do want to push on this because I think it's an important point. Regardless of the politics that we in this nerve center can or cannot control, a Republican president could presumably tell HHS to take apart elements of the ACA through regulation, regardless of what happens with Congress. So thinking about it this way, how much damage could a Republican president due to the ACA implementation through regs.
Yeah. So there's no question the SAR system works. If someone wanted to make the decision that they were going to look at 20 million newly covered Americans and take away that coverage, I feel like that would be an awfully, awfully difficult decision. Maybe an easier thing to talk about saying you're going to do. But I won't reveal any specific conversations, but as I talk to governors who are may be politically feel one way or the other about the ACA at a real pragmatic level, when you talk to them about Medicaid expansion, exchanges, and so on and so forth, and they really hear from and see the residents of their state and the impact of these policies on their state, they don't really want to be in a world where you've got a lot of people without insurance flooding the emergency room again, creating a lot of bad debt and all those things. So, I think a reasonable person would say that there are adjustments that people would look at depending on how they viewed the world. But I have to say, in this case, I'd be more optimistic than not that we are not going to go back to a place before we made all this progress where we were, I think, in a pretty stagnant situation.
So there are a panoply of things that have been introduced to help with ACA implementation or to make changes in the industry. Pilot programs, it seems like there might be one new pilot program a week sometimes at the pace that they're rolled out. What do you see as really sticking, and what might be the programs that aren't going to continue for the years to come?
Yeah, so I think now you're probably referring to payment models, right?
Yes.
Been talking about, yeah. So, in the grand scheme of things, the Medicare program, the Medicaid program, and quite frankly, all of the way people get cared, whether it's through their employer, are going through a transformation that started a few years ago, which is to figure out how to pay for quality and to align the payment system so we can pay physicians in ways that they do the things that support the needs of patients better. And I think that's broad movement, and just that's background on your question. So the agency and the administration started experimenting with some authorities from the ACA on pilots. And I think, to give you a sense of where I think we are, I think there are probably four things now that I think have legs, meaning they'll stick around. But I would also say is that...
Wait, what are those four things?
So those four things are bundles.
The bundled payment program.
Bundled payment programs, mm-hmm. which is essentially if you go in for a big thing like a surgery, we'll pay give the system one payment so that it forces them to coordinate how best to get you the quality care that they need. And it really is it become a great teaching tool because all of a sudden surgeons are incented to understand the best way to get you into recovery and to rehabilitation and so forth.
Right.
So that's one. Second are population health management. So accountable care organizations. Clearly those are going to be here to stay in some form.
Some Medicare ACOs have not been as successful.
And let me talk about, I was going to go there. You wanted me to name the four. Let me name the four and let me come back and address that. The third being primary care driven models. It's very clear that if we do more on the primary care side, we could prevent people, I'm going to cough, excuse me, from being sick later on.
You need a better primary care provider if clearly. That cough continues.
Clearly. And the fourth, which I think came out of, I think a surprise to many, are prevention models, like the new diabetes prevention program. But here's the point I would make about these programs. I'm looking at your phone. Is that an iPhone?
It is an iPhone.
It's an iPhone.
You've outed me.
It's an iPhone 6, 5?
iPhone 6.
iPhone 6. The models out there today are like the equivalent of the iPhone 1 or 2. They're very much you know, iPhone 1, you know, constructed in a lab. We think this is going to work. It hasn't seen daylight. We hope people like it. We hope it increases quality. We hope it saves money. In the case of the ACO, we just introduced what we call next-gen ACO, which is, I think, the equivalent of the iPhone 2. And it has a lot of the things that physicians have said, you know what, if only we could do this, if only we could do that. So if only we could engage patients more, if only we could use telemedicine. So all those things are in that second generation model. We just released generation 2 of the primary care model called CPC Plus, which gives...
Comprehensive primary care.
Right. Program, I'm not going to swear to your no acronym policy, Dan. Sorry.
Do you know how many acronyms there are on the CMS master list of acronyms?
911?
4,400 and I think 22.
4,422.
How many do you think you know?
How many did you really count them?
I used Excel to help me, but I was thinking about quizzing you at some point on, you know, name the acronym, explain what this is. We can save that for a future conversation.
You know, what's funny is in some of them, like you think you know it, and then you're like, is that extended or expanded? So
there are legitimately six different acronyms for ICN. I could maybe not even mention one or name one until I looked at the list. There also is an acronym for space and SpaceX, which I thought was kind of cool, and CMS sort of beat Musk to market.
It feels like there's some conspiracy to try to confuse consumers because we have a system that, generally speaking, was developed that would never happen in a system that was developed around a consumer and a consumer need. We clearly have a system that was developed some other way. It was developed for purchasers, employers. It was developed for people who provide care, but nothing was ever done in ways that make sense for normal people, because you don't see these acronyms in areas where that doesn't happen. It's actually one of the great promises of moving to kind of an exchange-driven, more retail-centered world, is it's going to have to get simpler and more focused. But it's a big journey.
So just one follow-up question there. If you're thinking about all these different programs like a venture fund and you've got private sector background, how many need to be successful for the CMS push here to work? 50%, 20%? In the venture capital world, 1 out of 10 investments being successful is a win?
Yeah. So here's the way I think. You have to look at it the same way you look at product development. I don't think you want quite as many failures as an early stage venture, but you do, I think, have to tolerate. And it's very important that you tolerate failures if in those failures you can extract learning. So everybody has a point of view of what's going to work. Everybody has ideas of what's going to work. We have a pretty rigorous gate, which is the independent actuaries have to say, this thing can save money, help care, help people with better care, and scale, which is a pretty rigorous gate. And for that to happen, you have to figure out the ones that don't work or don't work as well as they should and apply those lessons in the ones that do. So the next-gen ACO model doesn't just take into account lessons from the first pioneer ACO, but it takes into account lessons from all the other ACOs. And eventually those things ration their way out. But we have to have a tolerance for this, and that means that people are part of the experimentation process.
Right. Some things are going to work, some things aren't going to work. United Healthcare, your former employer, said the ACA exchanges didn't work for them. What does it mean when the nation's largest insurer says that it's struggling with the ACA?
So I want to avoid commenting on any specific companies. And you're smart enough to know a couple of things I'm about to tell you. So, first of all, I think some companies are successful and some companies, haven't been as successful. I think relates to a number of different things. Some of it relates to the strategy. Some of it relates to how they approach the market. And clearly that's going to be more interesting for us all to focus on the ones that are retrenching a little bit. But even the ones that are retrenching are finding ways to stay in the market or grow in certain markets. But, yesterday there was a big announcement of a public company that's actually said we're doing well.
And since you can't say it, I will. Centene, mm-hmm. the managed care company, said right. it's doing well. Yep. So again, United pulling out of dozens of markets.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that's going to happen. I think we're going to see that level of movement and disruption. I don't think everybody in the first year, we should expect that everybody in the first year had the perfect strategy, in part because it was impossible, because no one really knew what the population was going to look like. So people have different levels of risk tolerance. But so first point is, there are successful strategies. There are plenty of companies making money, plenty of companies doing well. Consumers have plenty of choices, and by and large, we'll still continue to have plenty of choices. The second thing I'd point out is that while it's been a bit of a mixed bag for some of the health plans, coming out of the ACA, the hospitals have done enormously well. They have...
Their margins are about as high as they've been in years, if ever.
Right. And so, you know, it's not as if there isn't... it's not as if the system doesn't have the ability to create more affordable products for consumers. It's just got to get jockeyed around a little bit, and that affordability has to be created and get back to consumers. There's a fundamental point here, which is that consumers are saying the same thing in a very personal way that I think all of us in the healthcare system should be saying, and have been saying, many of us as well, which is affordability is everybody's job. We have to create a more affordable system. Signing a piece of legislation by itself just sets the wheels in motion. But if you are a pharmaceutical company or a hospital or a health plan or anyone else in the system, part of your job now is to figure out how to intelligently make sure that our scarce resources are treated appropriately. And that means, it doesn't mean skimping on care. It means reducing waste. It means finding other ways to innovate and create new models for innovation. And we have to now not just do it because we have a Medicare trust fund or because we have financial budget issues. We have to do it because consumers are saying, hey, I'm now spending my money on this and I need to be able to afford my prescription. I need to be able to afford to go to the doctor in the hospital. And it's a beautiful start to see where we've come so far. You know, 20 million people covered, a market that's clearly successful and moving and working. We'll have to continue to work through whatever challenges arise, and I'm confident that we will. But most importantly, everybody in the system cannot be complacent. You know, we have to look at the situation and say, how do we create more affordability for consumers constantly?
So you've talked about some of the goals you've had for CMS. There are 9 months left. What can we look for, initiatives that might be coming soon that you are able to talk about that will be accomplishing these goals, changing the industry?
Yeah. So I think the things that are, the framing for the next 9 months, in some respects, it's not about jamming through a bunch of pet policy projects. That's the wrong way to look at it. It's really about advancing things that need to be advanced, that we can significantly advance, and setting the stage for things that people can do that come after us. So, you know, I was in Boston yesterday talking about drug prices, and I get asked a lot to talk about drug prices. And it's a really interesting space for us because as a country, by and large, we haven't really tackled the conversation, let alone created those strategies.
Though we are certainly starting to, for a variety of reasons, drug prices being something that the Senate is looking at this week.
Right, right. So it's part of the dialogue. And the question is, how are we going to approach these issues? It's very easy for somebody to take one side or the other of an issue and say, well, if we start talking about prices, we're never going to be able to have another innovation in this country again. And we can't have that. We can't have that. We have too many people in this country with advanced Alzheimer's and with cancer and with heart disease. We've got great scientists in this country. We've got opportunities for precision medicine to really tailor care. That's exciting, and we have to be able to afford that. But at the same time, you can't deliver those innovations and do them in a way where people can't have access to them and can't afford them. And it hits states, hardest because states have to balance their budgets every year by and large. And when they have large populations that need expensive medications, they don't have a lot of pockets. There are no magic pockets of money for them to pull from. So approaching this conversation, I feel like we're almost in the same space we were in 2010, 2011 with hospitals. We created ACOs and we created medical homes and we created bundled payments to say, are there a set of tools that we can work with the pharmaceutical industry on that are value-based models? And we've been approached by many pharmaceutical companies who've said, we know how to do this. We want to do this here. So I think there's some hope there to focus. There's also, I think, important other pieces to that puzzle. So that's not the only one. But my goal here would not be that we solve this problem in the next 9 months. My goal would be that I'll put it to you this way. If we don't address this problem in the next 4 or 5 years and prescription drug costs grow as they've been growing, this will be one of the top three issues for my successor, if not the number one issue. And with 5 years less time to solve the problem, the solution set space becomes smaller and more dramatic. So creating some tools and some capabilities now that we can work much as we've done with the hospital industry on ACOs and with physicians and learning whatever lessons we can there, I think is the smart thing to do. And I think if I don't, my successor will say, what the heck was Slavitt thinking?
Tools for physician payment changes are coming soon too. You just released MACRA. What do doctors need to know?
Yeah, I think the really exciting opportunity for us, And I've talked about this publicly, is I think we have, in the process of trying to put a lot of good ideas in place, really lost the hearts and minds of physicians who practice medicine every day. They feel over-regulated. They feel like we are requiring them to use technology that isn't working for them. And then we are measuring them in a really through a patchwork of methods. So the way we view this opportunity with MACRA, in some respects, to go back to my Apple product development analogy, this is our biggest product launch of the year, is to do everything we can to simplify how measurement and reward works. No one would argue with the concept that we should be paying based upon the kind of quality of care that gets delivered to our beneficiaries. Everyone would salute that. But the how part becomes really important. And today, what we have are a patchwork of measurement programs, one that measures your use of technology, one that measures your use of how much quality you get, one that measures the cost of your programs. You have to do a whole lot of individual reporting. So when bipartisan legislation, MACRA, passed, we step back and view this as an opportunity. Can you take this patchwork of programs, streamline them into one program,
right?
Make it easy to digest, easier to participate in, and then excuse me, create the flexibility that says we don't know better in Washington. You know better in your own office and your own practice which of these measures best applies to your practice, and put the physician back in a position of control. And the difference of how it feels to be in more control versus having a bunch of things imposed on you in sort of a one-size-fits-all fashion, I think makes an enormous difference. So that's why we approach this process very much in the field, listening to what physicians want. We'll put forward a proposal. We will then engage very actively, very actively. We will talk to and meet with hundreds and hundreds personally of physicians and thousands of physicians across the agency and patients and get their feedback.
So if MACRA is your biggest product launch, Apple style, this is your moment. Steve Jobs liked to say, just one more thing. Is there one more thing?
So I think there's a couple critical things in here. First of all, this is the focus is on how do we take a step to making the Medicare system one that pays for quality. So, that's the broad goal. For us, our underlying goal was how do we implement this in a way that's as simple as possible for physicians to use and that best matches the needs of their practice? And I think there are a couple of elements to that. One is to take the patchwork of measurement programs and payment programs and all those things that exist today and consolidate them into one platform that makes sense. And we've done that with the quality payment program, and we think that that will significantly both reduce burden, but also coordinate these programs, make it simpler. Second is to make this a practice-driven implementation, meaning we've created plenty of opportunities for a practice to look at what's in this quality payment program that we're implementing and decide based upon their practice which are the most relevant elements of it for their practice. So that flexibility, I think, is really important. And the third is there are a couple of different elements of the program and a couple of different options for physicians and other clinicians is to really create what we talk about as on-ramps and off-ramps so that physicians don't find themselves stuck in one program and decide they want to be part of another program. You know, we're mandated to have two different programs as part of quality payment program, and so we do that. And then I think the fourth thing I'd add for good measure was we took a really hard, clean sheet of paper look at meaningful use. Mm. And we decided we were going to, at the end of it, because there was so much that needed to be changed, replace it with a program that we're calling Advancing Care Information. And, you know, that's a program that is going to be much different in many ways as the way it's proposed, highly flexible, focused on interoperability, multiple ways for physicians and other clinicians to succeed based upon how they decide their practice works best. And we hope that we'll get the kind of reaction that we should. And I think it's important to say that I talked a little bit earlier in the conversation about user-based policy design. This was our biggest example of putting that into practice. So we had, I think, 6,000 conversations in putting this together. And these weren't Washington conversations with Washington doctors. These were practicing physicians, 8 local markets, focus groups, workshops, technologists, innovators. We've tried to put this out in as simple as way as possible. We're excited to get the reaction we're going to get. It was a very new way of doing things because it's that important.
So in terms of accountability and saying what works and what doesn't work, was meaningful use ultimately a failure?
Meaningful use was actually successful in accomplishing getting us to, I think, a certain place. And that place was 97% of hospitals and 70% of physician offices have computers. And remember, 6 years ago, people wouldn't invest in technology because it didn't make sense. There was no business case. So if we didn't have that, we wouldn't be able to do anything else. The question is actually, would meaningful use get us to the next place?
Right.
And, you know, ultimately we determined no. There's a better way to get to the next place than what we had in place.
Meaningful use is a stepping stone. We're now ready for the next step.
Yeah, I think so. And I think a much more physician-friendly, patient-friendly, interactive-driven approach with a lot of flexibility is really where we want to go next. And physicians tell us they need 3 things to change. One is they need burden to be reduced. Second is they find it absolutely amazing that they have technology that doesn't connect to other technology. So when a patient gets referred out to a hospital or another physician, that they can't track what happened. So that has to get fixed. And third, they need more usable technology, which basically means we need 2 things to happen. We need technology companies to design around the needs of users and how they work, physicians and patients, not around regulations. And secondly, we're putting in place these things called open APIs, which allows anybody to develop technology, not an EMR, not an EMR, an app, a widget that could plug right in to the workflow. And that should open up a new world of innovation.
So Andy, wanted to close just a lightning round of quick questions, looking for short, immediate, instinct answers. Best place to hold a lunch meeting in DC.
Place to hold a, you know, I have breakfast meetings. I just don't have lunch meetings. So
your desk is the best place to hold a lunch meeting.
Yeah, yeah, best, probably the best place. Yeah.
Worst government office building in DC.
I think there's one worse than this one, but I can't remember which one. There's a lot of beautiful ones. This one was designed in that brutalist style where even though you're near the Capitol, they put those kind of things in the window so you can't really look out of them.
Who's the hardest person to testify in front of in Congress? Like if you know that this person is going to be asking you questions, that you know you have to bring your A game.
You'd be wise to bring your A game, no matter who you're testifying in front of. They're all my favorites. I can't pick my favorite. I love them all.
You sound like Congress talking about Secretary Burwell, who they love incredibly.
You should ask me a question about Secretary Burwell in the lightning round.
What question should I ask you about Secretary Burwell in the lightning round?
You know, I can't think of a better model for an engaged public servant than Secretary Burwell. Fully engaged, fully hands-on, intellectually, morally, always wants to know what's the right thing to do, never wants to know just what's the next step or what's the thing that will look best, and always forces people to play an A game that they never even thought they had.
How good will the Minnesota Timberwolves be next year?
Awesome. They will be awesome.
Tom Thibodeau's the new coach.
Yep.
Do you believe in giving high fives in the workplace?
I don't touch my colleagues.
Always a safe policy.
Yeah, always a safe policy.
I like that we're a few feet away from each other, too. Yeah. Is healthcare one word or two words?
According to the New York Times, I think it's two.
That's the right answer. Where will you be next year? A year from today?
That is a really good question. I hope that the answer is very close to my wife and my kids, because that's been a two-year side journey. Other than that, you know, this job actually, depending how you look at it, either gives you the luxury of not thinking about what you're going to do next because it's so intense, but also because you touch every part of healthcare that you just sort of let it go. You know, I'm one of those people. We both went to the same school where you're sort of programmed to think about what you're going to do next at all times.
Penn was very pre-professional.
It was very pre-professional. This is probably, I know this isn't a lightning round answer, but this is probably the first job, the most important job, to not ever think about what else you're going to do. You know, on my last day here, I may make a mortal enemy by doing the right thing, and that's just the way it goes.
Well, wherever you are in a year, I hope we'll be able to sit down and do this again. Thank you so much for the time. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Dan, and great luck with this podcast. I'm listening to it on the way back to Minnesota.
You are the pilot program. You are the product launch for us. So thanks for participating.
And my oldest son just loves political podcasts, loves Politico. So I think he'll be one of your biggest listeners.
Well, hopefully he'll be a big fan of you too. Oh,
thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Dan.
That's it for Pulse Check this week. Thank you to my producer, Bridget Mulcahy, editorial assistant, Mary Lee. You can find the podcast by searching Pulse Check on iTunes and other apps. Please subscribe, and you can email ddiamond@politico.com with suggestions of who we should have on upcoming shows. But we do have some excellent guests lined up, and we'll be back again next week.